Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. For 17 years, Dr. John Pisando sounded the alarm about unethical and dangerous treatments at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle. He lost his job for speaking up about it, while the doctor responsible for the deaths of leukemia patients won a Nobel Prize. Carl Elliott published a book in the spring of 2024 entitled "The Occasional Human Sacrifice: Medical Experimentation and the Price of Saying No," in which he detailed these and many other cover-ups. Why do most people remain silent in the face of moral wrongdoing in their workplaces? Well, it's because they will pay a high price for speaking up about wrongdoing. They will be humiliated, threatened, and ostracized. Many lose their jobs. Elliott writes that those in power use a familiar pattern of suppression. They deny, delay, divide, and discredit. The four D's. Deny, delay, divide, and discredit. When Nancy Olivieri exposed the dangers of a drug to parents of children in a clinical trial, Barry Sherman and the drug company Epotex threatened her with a lawsuit. It took 18 years to settle the lawsuit, while the university where she worked harassed and disrupted her career because the drug company made the largest donation in the university's history. Children treated with the drug through the university's health system developed serious complications, and some died. Standing up for the truth often leads to harassment, attacks, false accusations, and threats. Daniel faced the same kind of harassment in his job recorded in Daniel chapter 6. I think this chapter in Daniel illustrates for us the same kinds of problems that we may face in the 21st century. In America, of course, we don't face the death penalty for such problems, but believers in other parts of the world do. Whenever believers are working in the world of business and government, the same kinds of forces are involved as in Daniel's day. When we speak the truth to power, power won't like it. The government or the company will attack, slander, and falsely accuse us for our integrity. We can learn much from Daniel's example about how to be faithful under fire. Let's examine the anatomy of workplace pressures as illustrated by Daniel 6. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Our integrity incites our enemies. Daniel 6:1-4. So who is Darius the Mede? Daniel 5:31 indicates that he received the kingdom of Babylon at about age 62. For many years, scholars who wanted to impugn the accuracy of Scripture considered this to be one of the major errors in the Bible. No Persian or Babylonian records indicate that Darius the Mede ruled Babylon during this time period. But we now know that the term Darius is a title, not a personal name. The title meant the holder of the scepter, or the royal one. It is borrowed from a Persian word that was used as a synonym for king. We also know that Cyrus, who conquered Babylon, was in the habit of making trusted generals and even kings from the conquered countries into vice regents under his authority. Cyrus appointed a man named Gubaru to be the authority over the Babylonian Empire for 2 years, while Cyrus went on to conquer other territories. Darius is likely the title for Gubaru. There's no reason not to accept the biblical record that Gubaru was from the country of Media, since Persia was allied with Media in the invasion, and that he was about 62 years of age. As the royal one, Darius, over the Babylonian Empire, he would certainly have been legitimately called king. Furthermore, the biblical record indicates that Darius was an appointed official. In Daniel 9:1, we read that Darius was made king over the kingdom of the Chaldeans. The Aramaic construction used here strongly suggests that he was appointed as king by a higher authority such as Cyrus. So, Darius the Mede is Gubaru, the Median general whom Cyrus appointed over the kingdom of Babylon until Cyrus could return and personally assume control over the kingdom. Darius appears to have been a good administrator. He divides the kingdom into 120 subdivisions and appoints administrators over these provinces. Then he appoints 3 commissioners to oversee the 120 governors. Daniel is appointed as one of the 3 commissioners. The purpose of his office seems to be primarily to protect the finances of the empire, so he would not suffer loss, the text says. Verse 2 tells us that the governors were to be accountable to the commissioners so that the king might not suffer loss. Daniel and the other 2 were to protect the assets of the king to keep political graft and corruption out of the system. Daniel distinguished himself immediately as an excellent administrator. He is in his early 80s by now, and he knows how to lead effectively. Yet verse 3 indicates that there is another reason for Daniel's skill. He possessed an extraordinary spirit. The implication is that along with his great experience and knowledge, he seemed to have a superhuman ability that set him apart from the other administrators. The result is that Daniel quickly moved to the top of the heap. He was singled out by the king, who intended to make him prime minister over the entire kingdom. So he must have been an exceptional administrator. Daniel is a great role model for men and women in the corporate or government world today. He would have been the kind of manager you would love to work for if you were a good employee. But if you were a poor employee, you would probably dislike him. So, my friends, be excellent in all you do. To be good at what you do is the best witness you can be for Christ. Achieve much and do the best job you can do. This honors God and brings personal and corporate success. However, the result of Daniel's success is jealousy. The other two commissioners didn't like being passed over for promotion, and they joined with many of the governors or satraps who searched for something they could use against Daniel. They could find no grounds for accusation in his career as a diplomat and an administrator. He was simply too good. They found no graft, corruption, dishonesty, or greed. Isn't that a great testimony for a Christian? Daniel was impeccable, according to verse 4. Then the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. The verse implies that there was a monetary motive for the search. Perhaps these other administrators wanted the freedom to practice corruption themselves in order to make money at the expense of the king. Corruption is very common in government, but they were unable to act corruptly as long as Daniel was running the show, because he was absolutely faithful to the king. No corruption was to be found in him. He was not negligent in any way. Daniel did his job, and he did it so well that others could find nothing for which he could be accused. Now remember, Daniel was a captive Jew. He could not have agreed with the government of Babylon or Persia from a spiritual perspective. These governments were pagan. They were filled with idolatry. Yet Daniel still did his job with excellence. The company profited from his abilities, and he remained absolutely loyal to the king. Can the same be said for you in your job? My friends, be a man or woman of integrity where you work. Stuart Briscoe tells of being hired by a bank. He was a young man and new in the business, just learning it. One day his boss told him, "Look, if Mr. So-and-so calls for me, tell him I'm out." Briscoe replied, "Oh, are you planning to go somewhere?" "No, I just don't want to speak to him, so tell him I'm out." "Let me make sure I understand. You want me to lie for you?" Well, the boss blew up at him. He was outraged. Stuart prayed, and God gave him a flash of insight. "Well, you should be happy, because if I won't lie for you, isn't it safe to assume that I won't lie to you?" Integrity works both ways. I remember my first year of marriage when I was working at a Rite Aid drugstore in Camden, New Jersey. I was going to college full-time and working as a stock clerk in the store. I needed the job because we didn't have much money. One day I was working out back when the telephone rang. In those days it was, of course, a landline phone on the wall of the stockroom. The manager answered the phone. He then put his hand over the phone and told me to come take it. He said that I should tell the person that he was not there that day. He didn't want to talk to him, of course, so he wanted me to lie for him. I told him I wouldn't lie for him, so he got someone else to do it. He took it out somewhat on me in the ensuing days. He was not happy with me for refusing to lie for him. But friends, integrity begins to slide when we make little moral compromises at work. It isn't worth it. Our integrity incites our enemies, first of all, and our enemies plan their attack, Daniel 6, 5 through 9. Then these men said, "We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. I like verse 5. We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. What a great testimony it would be if the only thing anyone could find against you or against me is that we follow Jesus Christ so fully that they had to attack our faith to get us in trouble. The plan was brilliant. The commissioners and the governors came in a group to meet with the king. Daniel, of course, was not among them. The group put great social pressure on the king to listen because, after all, these were his appointed administrators. The injunction was well thought out. They wanted any citizen who prayed to pray to the king for the next 30 days. This limited the demand, so it was not oppressive on the population, but it served to flatter the king, who was being treated as divine. The added benefit is that the king would see this as a unifying force in his empire. He was probably already concerned that the empire might break up into ethnic groups, and this ordinance could help bring the people together under his authority. It appealed to his ego. By the way, I want you to notice that the coalition lied about their demand. They said that all the commissioners and the satraps consulted together about the ordinance. Of course, Daniel had not been consulted. But the king was taken in by the claim, signed the injunction without taking time to consider the implications of his decision. Such a show of unity among his leaders clouded his vision about what should be checked out more carefully. The penalty under Persian law for praying to any other god than the king for the next 30 days was death. The convicted man or woman was to be thrown into an open pit where hungry lions were kept as a deterrent to criminal activity. Now, we do not face a choice that stark in our culture. Although you may face those in your corporation who attempt to manipulate the system so that you are maligned and your job in jeopardy, our government may require loyalty tests that compromise our faith. Our commitment to Christ could jeopardize our jobs in our country. But I would call your attention to the fact that Christians in other countries do face the death penalty for following Christ. The International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church lists Pakistan as the fifth most difficult place in the world to follow Jesus Christ. I grew up in the country of Pakistan, where my parents served as missionaries many years ago now. Christians are insulted and threatened regularly, and churches are attacked by mobs. Jobs are very limited for Christians. The government often advertises jobs sweeping the open sewers or cleaning latrines in such a way as to imply that only Christians can apply for these dirty jobs. These are the jobs Christians could do. When we were there, we saw that the sweeper communities were often where we found the most Christians. Sweepers keep the sewage lines running. They often must climb into sewage pits and deep gutters to clean out human waste in buckets without any safety equipment to protect them. Some have lost their lives from inhaling poisonous sewage gases. One man named Irfan Masse passed out and was taken to the doctor. But the doctor refused to touch the unconscious man because touching the dirty man would break his fast. Irfan Masse died shortly afterward because he was refused medical treatment. These are the jobs that Christians must take to make a living. Furthermore, Pakistan's blasphemy laws lead to condemning Christians to prison and even death if they insult Islam. Pakistani Christians know the cost of daring to be like Daniel in their culture. They suffer and die for their faith. So, first, our integrity incites our enemies. Second, our enemies plan their attack against us. And third, their attack tests our faithfulness, verses 10 and 11. Martin Niemöller, in 1934, stood in the pulpit of the church he pastored in the Berlin suburb of Dahlem and proclaimed these words to his congregation. "We have all of us, the whole church and the whole community. We've been thrown into the tempter's sieve, and he is shaking and the wind is blowing, and it must now become manifest whether we are wheat or chaff. It's a testing time, and God is giving Satan a free hand so he may shake us up and so that it may be seen what manner of men we are. Satan swings his sieve, and Christianity is thrown hither and thither, and he who is not ready to suffer, he who called himself a Christian only because he thereby hoped to gain something good for his race and his nation, is blown away like chaff by the wind of this time." Look at verses 10 and 11. "Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God." Daniel's habit was simple. He knelt to pray with his face toward Jerusalem three times a day before his open window. He had been following this practice for 60 years in Babylon, and Daniel saw no reason to stop now. He certainly knew about the document, but he prayed anyway. I would like to make several observations here. First, Daniel didn't take the easy way out. He could have just not prayed for 30 days. After all, no person was forced to pray to the king. The order prohibited praying to any other god, so he could have just not prayed at all. Or he could have simply prayed in private when no one else would notice. He could have prayed silently, like a quick prayer in a restaurant that's not visible to others. But he didn't take the easy way out of his predicament. Second observation, I noticed that Daniel didn't grandstand either. He didn't make a public display. His window remained open, facing Jerusalem, but that was his habit. It is what he always did. No pretense, no grandstanding. He simply went about his normal prayer routine. I like the comment of the British theologian P.T. Forsyth. "You pray as your face is set, towards Jerusalem or Babylon." Third, Daniel simply followed the habits he had practiced for a lifetime. He refused to be intimidated. These were spiritual habits that were ingrained into his life. He didn't suddenly invent these habits to make a point. He did what he had always done. He was faithful. In one region of Africa, the first converts to Christianity were very diligent about praying. In fact, the believers each had their own special place outside the village where they went to pray in solitude. The villagers reached these prayer rooms by using their own private footpaths through the brush. When grass began to grow over one of the trails, it was evident that the person to whom it belonged was not praying very much. Because these new Christians were concerned for each other's spiritual welfare, a unique system sprang up among them in their culture. Whenever anyone noticed an overgrown prayer path, he or she would go to the person and lovingly warn, "Friend, there's grass on your path. There's grass on your path." My friends, I've got two questions for you. First, which way is your face set? Toward the world or toward heaven? Where are you looking? Second, is there grass on your path? The habits of a lifetime are the habits we practice in a crisis. Finally, our faithfulness leads to God's opportunity in verses 12 to 15. Then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. "Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den?" The king replied, "The statement is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked." Then they answered and spoke before the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day." Then, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed." The other administrators quickly presented their case to the king. Verse 13 implies that there was some degree of racism in their accusation against Daniel. He was a captive Jew who had broken the law of the king. Darius realized that he had been tricked. He worked hard to rescue Daniel from the fate. He was deeply distressed, the text tells us, and he tried all day to keep Daniel from being thrown to the lions. But he was caught in his own mistake. The law of the Medes and the Persians was supposed to be inviolable. The tradition was that when a king affixed his signature to a law, it was considered an act done by a deity. There could be no mistake. Furthermore, according to Oriental customs, the punishment was to be carried out on the day that the person was convicted. The king was also caught in a political problem. He was, after all, only second in command under Cyrus. It would certainly be reported to Cyrus if he did not carry out his own decree. Darius, or Gubaru, is answerable to the king for the administration of Babylon. P.T. Forsyth was right when he said, "The first duty of every soul is to find not its freedom, but its master." Who is our master? Is our master the law of men, or the law of God? Is our master the politics of earthly success, or the principles of heavenly values? Who owns you? Who owns me? Ernest Wadsworth wrote, "Pray for a faith that will not shrink when washed in the waters of affliction." As we look at verse 15, it would appear that all is lost for Daniel. The enemy has won. Loyalty to God simply bought him the lion's den. But it's not the case at all, as we all well know. God had set up Daniel's faith. God had set up the situation. and Daniel's faith would lead to God's opportunity. Daniel did not know it at the time. All he could do was remain loyal and trust God to open the doors of opportunity. Had Daniel taken the easy way out, God would not have had the opportunity to display his glory before the nation. God intended this as a setup for Daniel so that God could display his glory. Well, the same is true for us. God may put us in situations that are difficult for us, but opportunities for God. Are we loyal to God, or do we look for loopholes? If we're always looking for loopholes so we don't have to suffer any problems, we will never see God do great things through our lives. We will always be looking for the easy way out, the loophole. Taking the easy way out means we miss the opportunities to display God's glory. Our faithfulness to God leads to his opportunity for glory. You see, God uses our faithfulness to achieve his goals, despite the circumstances and the struggles and the opposition that we might face. John Wesley was a great preacher in the 1700s who founded the Methodist Church. I love this series of entries in his personal diary. Sunday a.m., May 5, preached in St. Anne's, was asked not to come back anymore. Sunday p.m., May 5, preached in St. John's, deacon said get out and stay out. Sunday a.m., May 12, preached in St. Jude's, can't go back there either. Sunday a.m., May 19, preached in St. Somebody Else's, deacons called a special meeting and said I couldn't return. Sunday p.m., May 19, preached on street, kicked off street. Sunday a.m., May 26, preached in Meadow, chased out of Meadow as bull was turned loose during service. Sunday a.m., June 2, preached out at the edge of town, kicked off the highway. Sunday p.m., June 2, afternoon, preached in a pasture. 10,000 people came out to hear me. 10,000 people came out to hear me. And revival swept the nation. God uses our faithfulness to achieve his goals.